Saturday, Disc 3.
The quality of silence in the house is thickened, Perrone can't help unscientifically thinking, by the fact of Theo deeply asleep on the third floor, face down under the duvet of his double bed. Some oblivious hours lie ahead of him yet. When he wakes, he'll listen to music fed through his hi-fi via the internet. He'll shower and talk on the phone. Hunger won't drive him from his room until the early afternoon when he'll come down to the kitchen and make it his own, placing more calls, playing CDs, drinking a pint or two of juice and messily concocting a salad or a bowl of yogurt, dates, honey, fruit and chopped nuts. This fare seems to Henry to be at odds with the blues. Arriving on the first floor, he pauses outside the library, the most imposing room in the house, momentarily drawn by the way sunshine, filtering through the tall, gauzy oatmeal drapes, washes the room in a serious, brown and bookish light. The collection was put together by Marianne. Henry never imagined he would end up living in the sort of house that had a library. It's an ambition of his to spend whole weekends in there, stretched out on one of the Knoll sofas, pot of coffee at his side, reading some world-rank masterpiece or other, perhaps in translation. He has no particular book in mind. He thinks it would be no bad thing to understand what's meant, what Daisy means by literary genius. He's not sure he's ever experienced it at first hand, despite various attempts. He even half doubts its existence. But his free time is always fragmented, not only by errands and family obligations and sports, but by the restlessness that comes with these weekly islands of freedom. He doesn't want to spend his days off lying or even sitting down. Nor does he really want to be a spectator of other lives, of imaginary lives. Even though these past hours he's put in an unusual number of minutes gazing from the bedroom window. And it interests him less to have the world reinvented. He wants it explained. The times are strange enough. Why make things up? He doesn't seem to have the dedication to read many books all the way through. Only at work is he single-minded. At leisure, he's too impatient. He's surprised by what people say they achieve in their spare time, putting in 4 or 5 hours a day in front of the TV to keep the national averages up. During a lull in a procedure last week, the micro-Doppler failed and a replacement had to come from another theatre. J. Strauss stood up from the monitors and dials of his anaesthetic machine and, stretching his arms and yawning, said he was awake in the small hours finishing an 800-page novel by some new American prodigy. Perrone was impressed and bothered. Did he himself simply lack seriousness? In fact, under Daisy's direction, Henry has read the whole of Anna Karenina and Madame Bovary, two acknowledged masterpieces. At the cost of slowing his mental processes and many hours of his valuable time, he committed himself to the shifting intricacies of these sophisticated fairy stories. What did he grasp after all? That adultery is understandable but wrong, that 19th-century women had a hard time of it, that Moscow and the Russian countryside and provincial France were once just so. If, as Daisy said, the genius was in the detail, then he was unmoved. The details were apt and convincing enough, but surely not so very different to Marshall if you were halfway observant and had the patience to write them all down. These books were the products of steady, workmanlike accumulation. They had the virtue, at least, of representing a recognisable physical reality, which could not be said for the so-called magical realists she opted to study in her final year. What were these authors of reputation doing? Grown men and women of the 20th century granting supernatural powers to their characters? He never made it all the way through a single one of those irksome confections, and written for adults, not children. In more than one, heroes and heroines were born with or sprouted wings, a symbol in Daisy's term of their liminality, Naturally, learning to fly became a metaphor for bold aspiration. Others were granted a magical sense of smell, or tumbled unharmed out of high-flying aircraft. One visionary saw through a pub window his parents, as they had been some weeks after his conception, discussing the possibility of aborting him. A man who attempts to ease the miseries of failing minds by repairing brains is bound to respect the material world, its limits, and what it can sustain. Consciousness, no less. It isn't an article of faith with him. He knows it for a quotidian fact. The mind is what the brain, mere matter, performs. If that's worthy of awe, it also deserves curiosity. The actual, not the magical, should be the challenge. This reading list persuaded Perrone that the supernatural was the recourse of an insufficient imagination, a dereliction of duty, a childish evasion of the difficulties and wonders of the real, of the demanding reenactment of the plausible. "No more magic midget drummers," he pleaded with her by post after setting out his tirade. "Please, no more ghosts, angels, satans, or metamorphoses. When anything can happen, nothing much matters. It's all kitsch to me." "You ninny," she reproved him on a postcard. "You grad grind. It's literature, not physics." They had never conducted one of their frequent arguments by post before. He wrote back, "Tell that to your Flaubert and Tolstoy. Not a single winged human between them." She replied by return of post, "Look at your Madame Bovary again." There followed a set of page references. "He was warning the world against people just like you." Last three words heavily underscored. So far, Daisy's reading lists have persuaded him that fiction is too humanly flawed, too sprawling and hit and miss to inspire uncomplicated wonder at the magnificence of human ingenuity, of the impossible dazzlingly achieved. Perhaps only music has such purity. Above all others, he admires Bach, especially the keyboard music. Yesterday, he listened to two partitas in the theatre while working on Andrea's Astrocytoma. And then there are the usual suspects. Mozart, Beethoven, Schubert. His jazz idols. Evans, Davis, Coltrane. Cézanne among various painters. Certain cathedrals Henry has visited on holidays. Beyond the arts, his list of sublime achievement would include Einstein's general theory, whose mathematics he briefly grasped in his early 20s. He should make that list, he decides as he descends the broad stone stairs to the ground floor, though he knows he never will. Work that you cannot begin to imagine achieving yourself, that displays a ruthless, nearly inhuman element of self-enclosed perfection. This is his idea of genius. This notion of Daisy's that people can't live without stories is simply not true. He is living proof. By the front door, he picks up the post and the newspapers. Walking down to the kitchen, he reads the headlines. Blix telling the UN the Iraqis are beginning to cooperate. In response, the Prime Minister is expected to emphasize in a speech in Glasgow today the humanitarian reasons for war. In Perrone's view, the only case worth making. But the PM's late switch looks cynical. Henry is hoping that his own story, breaking at 4:30, might just have made the late editions in London. But there's nothing. No one's been in the kitchen since he left it. On the table are his cup, Theo's empty mineral water bottle, and beside it, the remote control. It's still faintly surprising, this rigid fidelity of objects. Sometimes reassuring, sometimes sinister. He takes the remote, turns the set on, and pushes the mute button. The 9 o'clock bulletin is several minutes away yet, and fills the kettle. What simple accretions have brought the humble kettle to this peak of refinement? Jug-shaped for efficiency, plastic for safety, wide spout for ease of filling, and clunky little platform to pick up the power. He never complained about the old style, the sticking tin lid, the thick black feminine socket waiting to electrocute wet hands seemed in the nature of things. But someone had thought about this carefully, and now there's no going back. The world should take note. Not everything is getting worse. The news comes on while he's grinding the beans. The new anchor is an attractive dark-skinned woman whose plucked, widely arched eyebrows express surprise at the challenge of yet another new morning. First, pictures from a motorway bridge of scores of coaches bringing marchers into the city for what is expected to be the biggest display of public protest ever seen. Then a reporter down among an early gathering of demonstrators by the embankment. All this happiness on display is suspect. Everyone is thrilled to be together out on the streets. People are hugging themselves, it seems, as well as each other. If they think, and they could be right, that continued torture and summary executions, ethnic cleansing and occasional genocide are preferable to an invasion, they should be somber in their view. The airplane, Henry's airplane, is now second item. The same pictures, and only a few more details. An electrical fault is suspected to be the cause of the fire. Standing with some policemen, the two Russians. The pilot, a shriveled fellow with oily hair, and his co-pilot, plump and oddly merry. They look suntanned, or perhaps they're from one of the southern republics. The fading life chances of a disappointing news story. No villains, no deaths, no suspended outcome, are revived by a dose of manufactured controversy. An aviation expert has been found who's prepared to say that it was reckless to bring a burning plane in over a densely populated area when there were other options. A representative of the airport authority says there was no threat to Londoners. The government is yet to comment. He turns the TV off, pulls up a stool, and sets himself up with his coffee and the phone. Before his Saturday can begin, there's a follow-up call to make to the hospital. He's put through to intensive care and asks to speak to the nurse in charge. While someone fetches her, he listens to the familiar background murmur, a porter's voice he recognises, a book or folder slapped down on a table. Then he hears the expressionless tone of a busy woman say, "I see you." "Deirdre? I thought Charles was on this weekend." "He's away with the flu, Mr. Perrone." "How's Andrea?" "GCS is 15, good oxygenation, not confused."
"EVD?
"Still draining at around 5 centimetres. I'm thinking of sending her back to the ward."
"That's fine then," Perrone said.
"Can you let the anaesthetist know that I'm happy for her to go?" He's about to hang up when he adds, "Is she giving you any trouble?" "Too overwhelmed by it all, Mr. Perrone. We love her like this."
He takes his keys and phone and garage remote control from a silver dish by the recipe books. His wallet is in an overcoat hanging in a room behind the kitchen, outside the wine vaults. His squash racket is upstairs on the ground floor in a cupboard in the laundry. He puts on an old hiking fleece and is about to set the burglar alarm when he remembers Theo inside. As he steps outside and turns from closing the door, he hears the squeal of seagulls come inland for the city's good pickings. The sun is low and only one half of the square, his half, is in full sunlight. He walks away from the square along blinding moist pavement, surprised by the freshness of the day. The air tastes almost clean. He has an impression of striding along a natural surface, along some coastal wilderness, on a smooth slab of basalt causeway he vaguely recalls from a childhood holiday. It must be the cry of the gulls bringing it back. He can remember the taste of spray off a turbulent blue-green sea, and as he reaches Warren Street, he reminds himself that he mustn't forget the fishmongers. Lifted by the coffee, and by movement at last, as well as the prospect of the game and the comfortable fit of the sheathed racket in his hand, he increases his pace.
The streets round here are usually empty at weekends, but up ahead, along the Euston Road, a big crowd is making its way east towards Gower Street. And in the road itself, crawling in the eastbound lanes, are the same nose-to-tail coaches he saw on the news. The passengers are pressed against the glass, longing to be out there with the rest. They've hung their banners from the windows, along with football scarves and the names of towns from the heart of England: Stratford, Gloucester, Evesham. From the impatient pavement crowds, some dry runs with the noisemakers. A trombone, a squeeze-ball car horn, a lambeg drum. There are ragged practice chants, which at first he can't make out. Tum-ti-tum-ti-tum. Don't attack Iraq. Placards not yet on duty are held at a slope, at rakish angles over shoulders. Not in my name goes past a dozen times. Its cloying self-regard suggests a bright new world of protest, with the fussy consumers of shampoos and soft drinks demanding to feel good or nice. Henry prefers the languid, down with this sort of thing. A placard of one of the organising groups goes by, the British Association of Muslims. Henry remembers that outfit well. It explained recently in its newspaper that apostasy from Islam was an offence punishable by death. Behind comes a banner proclaiming the Swaffham Women's Choir, and then Jews Against the War. On Warren Street he turns right. Now his view is east, towards the Tottenham Court Road. Here's an even bigger crowd, swelled by hundreds, disgorging from the tube station. Backlit by the low sun, silhouetted figures break away and merge into a darker mass. But it's still possible to see a makeshift bookstall and a hot dog stand, cheekily set up right outside McDonald's on the corner. It's a surprise the number of children there are, and babies in pushchairs. Despite his scepticism, Perrone in white-soled trainers, gripping his racket tighter, feels the seduction and excitement peculiar to such events. A crowd possessing the streets. Tens of thousands of strangers converging with a single purpose, conveying an intimation of revolutionary joy. He might have been with them, in spirit at least, for nothing now will keep him from his game, if Professor Taleb hadn't needed an aneurysm clipped on his middle cerebral artery. In the months after those conversations, Perrone drifted into some compulsive reading up on the regime. He read about the inspirational example of Stalin and the network of family and tribal loyalties that sustained Saddam and the palaces handed out as rewards. Henry became acquainted with the sickly details of genocides in the north and south of the country, the ethnic cleansing, the vast system of informers, the bizarre tortures, and Saddam's taste for getting personally involved, and the strange punishments passed into law. The brandings and amputations. Naturally, Henry followed closely the accounts of measures taken against surgeons who refused to carry out these mutilations. He concluded that viciousness had rarely been more inventive or systematic or widespread. Miri was right, it really was a republic of fear. Henry read Makiya's famous book too. It seemed clear Saddam's organising principle was terror. Perrone knows that when a powerful imperium, Assyrian, Roman, American, makes war and claims just cause, history will not be impressed. He also worries that the invasion or the occupation will be a mess. The marchers could be right, and he acknowledges the accidental nature of opinions. If he hadn't met and admired the professor, he might have thought differently, less ambivalently, about the coming war. Opinions are a roll of the dice. By definition, none of the people now milling around Warren Street Tube Station happens to have been tortured by the regime, or knows and loves people who have, or even knows much about the place at all. It's likely most of them barely registered the massacres in Kurdish Iraq or in the Shiite South, and now they find they care with a passion for Iraqi lives. They have good reasons for their views, among which are concerns for their own safety. Al-Qaeda, it said, which loathes both godless Saddam and the Shiite opposition, will be provoked by an attack on Iraq into revenge on the soft cities of the West. Self-interest is a decent enough cause, but Perone can't feel, as the marchers themselves probably can, that they have an exclusive hold on moral discernment. The sandwich bars along the street are closed up for the weekend. Only the flute shop and newsagent are open. Outside the Rive Gauche Traiteur, the owner is using a zinc bucket to sluice down the pavement, Parisian style. Coming towards Perone, his back to the crowds, is a pink-faced man of about his own age in a baseball cap and yellow day-glow jacket with a handcart, sweeping the gutter for the council. He seems oddly intent on making a good job, jabbing the corner of his broom hard into the angles of the curb, chasing out the scraps. His vigour and thoroughness are uncomfortable to watch, a quiet indictment on a Saturday morning. What could be more futile than this underpaid urban-scale housework when behind him, at the far end of the street, cartons and paper cups are spreading thickly under the feet of demonstrators gathered outside McDonald's on the corner? And beyond them, across the metropolis, a daily blizzard of litter. As the two men pass, their eyes meet briefly, neutrally. The whites of the sweeper's eyes are fringed with egg-yellow shading to red along the lids. For a vertiginous moment, Henry feels himself bound to the other man, as though on a seesaw with him, pinned to an axis that could tip them into each other's life. Perone looks away and slows before turning into the mews where his car is garaged. How restful it must have been in another age to be prosperous and believe that an all-knowing supernatural force had allotted people to their stations in life, and not see how the belief served your own prosperity. A form of anosognosia, a useful psychiatric term for a lack of awareness of one's own condition. Now we think we do see, how do things stand? After the ruinous experiments of the lately deceased century, after so much vile behaviour, so many deaths, a queasy agnosticism has settled around these matters of justice and redistributed wealth. No more big ideas. The world must improve, if at all, by tiny steps. People mostly take an existential view. Having to sweep the streets for a living looks like simple bad luck. It's not a visionary age. The streets need to be clean. Let the unlucky enlist. He walks down a faint incline of greasy cobbles to where the owners of houses like his own once kept their horses. Now, those who can afford it cosset their cars here with off-street parking. Attached to his keyring is an infrared button which he presses to raise a clattering steel shutter. It's revealed in mechanical jerks, a long nose and shining eyes at the stable door, chafing to be free. A silver Mercedes S500 with cream upholstery, and he's no longer embarrassed by it. He doesn't even love it. It's simply a sensual part of what he regards as his overgenerous share of the world's goods. If he didn't own it, he tries to tell himself, someone else would. He hasn't driven it in a week, but in the gloom of the dry, dustless garage, the machine breathes an animal warmth of its own. He opens the door and sits in. He likes driving it wearing his threadbare sports clothes. On the front passenger seat is an old copy of the Journal of Neurosurgery, which carries a report of his on a convention in Rome. He tosses his squash racket on top of it. It's Theo who disapproves most, saying it's a doctor's car, as if this were the final word in condemnation. Daisy, on the other hand, said she thought that Harold Pinter owned something like it, which made it all fine with her. Rosalind encouraged him to buy it. She thinks his life is too guiltily austere, and never buying clothes or good wine or a single painting is a touch pretentious. Still living like a postgraduate student, it was time for him to fill out. For months, he drove it apologetically, rarely in fourth gear, reluctant to overtake, waving on right-turning traffic, punctilious in permitting cheaper cars their road space. He was cured at last by a fishing trip to northwest Scotland with J. Strauss. Seduced by the open road and Jay's exultant celebration of Lutheran genius, Henry finally accepted himself as the owner, the master, of his vehicle. In fact, he's always quietly considered himself a good driver. As in the theatre, firm, precise, defensive to the correct degree. He and Jay fished the streams and lochans around Torridon for brown trout. One wet afternoon, glancing over his shoulder while casting, Henry saw his car, 100 yards away, parked at an angle on a rise of the track, picked out in soft light against a backdrop of birch, flowering heather and thunderous black sky, the realization of an ad man's vision, and felt for the first time a gentle swooning joy of possession. It is, of course, possible, permissible, to love an inanimate object. But this moment was the peak of the affair. Since then, his feelings have settled into mild, occasional pleasure. The car gives him vague satisfaction when he's driving it. The rest of the time, it rarely crosses his mind. As its makers intended and promised, it's become part of him. But certain small things still stir him particularly, like the way the car idles without vibration. The rev counter alone confirms the engine is turning. He switches on the radio, which is playing sustained, respectful applause as he eases out of the garage, lets the steel shutter drop behind him, and goes slowly up the mews and turns left back into Warren Street. His squash club is in Huntley Street, in a converted nurse's home. No distance at all, but he's driving because he has errands to do afterwards. Shamelessly, he always enjoys the city from inside his car, where the air is filtered and hi-fi music confers pathos on the humblest details. A Schubert string trio is dignifying the narrow street he's slipping down now. He's heading a couple of blocks south in order to loop eastwards across the Tottenham Court Road. Cleveland Street used to be known for garment sweatshops and prostitutes. Now it has Greek, Turkish and Italian restaurants. The local sort that never get mentioned in the guides, with terraces where people eat out in summer. There's a man who repairs old computers, a fabric shop, a cobbler's, and further down a wig emporium, much visited by transvestites. This is the fair embodiment of an inner city byway, diverse, self-confident, obscure. And it's at this point he remembers the source of his vague sense of shame or embarrassment, his readiness to be persuaded that the world has changed beyond recall, that harmless streets like this and the tolerant life they embody can be destroyed by the new enemy, well-organized, tentacular, full of hatred and focused zeal. How foolishly apocalyptic those apprehensions seem by daylight, when the self-evident fact of the streets and the people on them are their own justification, their own insurance. The world has not fundamentally changed. Talk of a 100-year crisis is indulgence. There are always crises, and Islamic terrorism will settle into place, alongside recent wars, climate change, the politics of international trade, land and freshwater shortages, hunger, poverty, and the rest. He listens to the Schubert sweetly fade and swell. The street is fine, and the city, grand achievement of the living and all the dead who've ever lived here, is fine too, and robust. It won't easily allow itself to be destroyed. It's too good to let go. Life in it has steadily improved over the centuries for most people, despite the junkies and beggars now. The air is better, and salmon are leaping in the Thames, and otters are returning. At every level, material, medical, intellectual, sensual, for most people it has improved. The teachers who educated Daisy at university thought the idea of progress old-fashioned and ridiculous. In indignation, Perrone grips the wheel tighter in his right hand. He remembers some lines by Medawar, a man he admires. "To deride the hopes of progress is the ultimate fatuity. The last word in poverty of spirit and meanness of mind." Yes, he's a fool to be taken in by that 100-year claim.
In Daisy's final term, he went to an open day at her college. The young lecturers there like to dramatise modern life as a sequence of calamities. It's their style, their way of being clever. It wouldn't be cool or professional to count the eradication of smallpox as part of the modern condition, or the recent spread of democracies. In the evening, one of them gave a lecture on the prospects for our consumerist and technological civilization. Not good. But if the present dispensation is wiped out now, the future will look back on us as gods. Certainly in this city. Lucky gods blessed by supermarket cornucopias, torrents of accessible information, warm clothes that weigh nothing, extended lifespans, wondrous machines. This is an age of wondrous machines. Portable telephones barely bigger than your ear. Vast music libraries held in an object the size of a child's hand. Cameras that can beam their snapshots around the world. Effortlessly, he ordered up the contraption he's riding in now through a device on his desk via the internet. The computer-guided stereotactic array he used yesterday has transformed the way he does biopsies. Digitalized entertainment binds that Chinese couple walking hand in hand, listening through a Y-socket to their personal stereo. And she's almost skipping, that stringy girl in a shell suit behind a three-wheel all-terrain pushchair. In fact, everyone he's passing now along this pleasantly down-at-heel street looks happy enough, at least as content as he is. But for the professors in the academy, for the humanities generally, misery is more amenable to analysis. Happiness is a harder nut to crack. In a spirit of aggressive celebration of the times, Perrone swings the Mercedes east into Maple Street. His well-being appears to need spectral entities to oppose it, figures of his own invention whom he can defeat. He's sometimes like this before a game. He doesn't particularly like himself in this frame, but the second-by-second wash of his thoughts is only partially his to control. The drift, the white noise of solitary thought, is driven by his emotional state. Perhaps he isn't really happy at all. He's psyching himself up. He's passing by the building at the foot of the post office tower, less ugly these days with its aluminium entrance, blue cladding and geometric masses of windows and ventilation grills looking like a Mondrian. But further along, where Fitzroy becomes Charlotte Street, the neighbourhood is packed with penny-pinching office blocks and student accommodation, ill-fitting windows, low ambition, not lasting well. In the rain and in the right temper, you can imagine yourself back in communist Warsaw. Only when enough of them have been torn down will it be possible to start loving them. Henry is now parallel to and two blocks south of Warren Street. He's still bothered by his peculiar state of mind, this happiness cut with aggression. As he approaches the Tottenham Court Road, he begins a familiar routine, listing the recent events that may have shaped his mood. That he and Rosalind made love, that it's Saturday morning, that this is his car, that no one died in the plane, and there's a game ahead, and the Chapman girl, and his other patients from yesterday are stable, that Daisy is coming. All this is to the good. And on the other hand? On the other hand, he's touching the brake. There's a motorbike policeman in a yellow jacket in the middle of the Tottenham Court Road with his machine on its stand, holding out an arm to stop him. Of course, the road is closed for the march. He should have known. But still, Perrone keeps coming, slowing all the while as if by pretending not to know he can be exempted. After all, he only wants to cross this road, not drive down it. Or at least he'll receive his due, a little drama of exchange between a firm but apologetic policeman and the solemnly tolerant citizen. He stops at the junction of the two roads. And indeed, the cop is coming towards him with a glance up the street at the marchers and a pursed, tolerant smile that suggests he himself would have bombed Iraq long ago and many other countries besides.
Perrone, relaxed at the wheel, would have responded with a collegiate, closed-mouthed smile of his own, but two things happen, almost at the same time. Behind the patrolman on the far side of the road, three men, two tall, one thick-set and short and wearing a black suit, are hurrying out of a lap-dancing club, the spearmint rhino almost stumbling in their efforts not to run. When they turn the corner into the street Perrone is wanting to enter, they're no longer so restrained. With the shorter man lagging behind, they run towards a car parked on the near side. The second thing to happen is that the cop, meanwhile, unaware of the men, suddenly stops on his way to Perrone and raises a hand to his left ear. He nods and speaks into a microphone fixed in front of his mouth and turns towards his bike. Then, remembering what he was about, he glances back. Perrone meets his eye and, with a self-deprecating, interrogative look, points across the road at University Street. The cop shrugs and then nods and makes a gesture with his hand to say, "Do it quickly, then. What the hell?" The marchers are still mostly up the other end and he's had fresh instructions. Perrone isn't late for his game, nor is he impatient to be across the road. He likes his car, but he's never been interested in the details of its performance, its acceleration from a standing start. He assumes it's impressive, but he's never put it to the test. He's far too old to be leaving rubber at the traffic lights. As he slips into first, he looks diligently in both directions, even though it's a one-way flow northwards. He knows that pedestrians could be coming from either direction. If he moves briskly across the four-lane width of the road, it's out of consideration for the policeman who's already starting up his bike. Perrone doesn't want the man in trouble with his superiors. And something about the hand gesture has communicated the need to be quick. By the time the Mercedes has travelled the 60 or 70 feet to the entrance of University Street, which is where he changes into second, he may be doing 20 miles an hour. 25, perhaps. 30 at a stretch. And even as he's changing up, he's easing off, looking out for the right turn before Gower Street, which is also closed off. And the forward motion is a prompt. It instantly returns him to his list, the proximal and distal causes of his emotional state. A second can be a long time in introspection. Long enough for Henry to make a start on the negative features, certainly enough time for him to think or sense without unwrapping the thought into syntax and words, that it is in fact the state of the world that troubles him most, and the marchers are there to remind him of it. The world probably has changed fundamentally, and the matter is being clumsily handled, particularly by the Americans. There are people around the planet, well-connected and organized, who would like to kill him and his family and friends to make a point. The scale of death contemplated is no longer at issue. There'll be more deaths on a similar scale, probably in this city. Is he so frightened that he can't face the fact? The assertions and the questions don't spell themselves out. He experiences them more as a mental shrug followed by an interrogative pulse. This is the pre-verbal language that linguists call mental ease. Hardly a language, more a matrix of shifting patterns, consolidating and compressing meaning in fractions of a second, and blending it inseparably with its distinctive emotional hue, which itself is rather like a colour. A sickly yellow. Even with a poet's gift of compression, it could take hundreds of words and many minutes to describe. So that when a flash of red streaks in across his left peripheral vision, like a shape on his retina in a bout of insomnia, it already has the quality of an idea, a new idea, unexpected and dangerous, but entirely his, and not of the world beyond himself. He's driving with unconscious expertise into the narrow column of space framed on the right by a curb-flanked cycle path, and on the left by a line of parked cars. It's from this line that the thought springs, and with it, the snap of a wing mirror cleanly sheared and the whine of sheet steel surfaces sliding under pressure as two cars pour into a gap wide enough for one. Perrone's instant decision at the moment of impact is to accelerate as he swerves right. There are other sounds, the staccato rattle of the red car on his left raking a half dozen stationary vehicles, and the thwack of concrete against rubber like an amplified single hand clap as the Mercedes mounts the cycle path curb. His back wheel hits the curb too. Then he's ahead of the intruder and braking. The slewed cars stop 30 yards apart, engines cut, and for a moment there's silence, and no one gets out. By the standards of contemporary road traffic accidents, Henry has done a total of 5 years in accident and emergency. This is a trivial matter. No one can possibly be hurt, and he won't be in the role of doctor at the scene. He's done it twice in the past 5 years, both for heart attacks. Once on a flight to New York, another time in an airless London theatre during a June heat wave. Both occasions unsatisfactory and complicated. He's not in shock. He's not weirdly calm or elated or numbed. His vision isn't unusually sharp. He isn't trembling. He listens to the click of hot metal contracting. What he feels is rising irritation, struggling against worldly caution. He doesn't have to look. One side of his car is wrecked. He already sees ahead into the weeks, the months of paperwork, insurance claims and counterclaims, phone calls, delays at the garage. Something original and pristine has been stolen from his car and can never be restored, however good the repair. There's also the impact on the front axle, on the bearings, on those mysterious parts which conjure the essence of prolonged torture. Rack and pinion. His car will never be the same again. It's ruinously altered, and so is his Saturday. He'll never make his game. Above all, there swells in him a peculiarly modern emotion. The motorist's rectitude, spot-welding a passion for justice to the thrill of hatred, in the service of which various worn phrases tumble through his thoughts, revitalized, cleansed of cliché. Just pulled out, no signal, stupid bastard, didn't even look, what's his mirror for, fucking bastard. The only person in the world he hates is sitting in the car behind, and Henry is going to have to talk to him, confront him, exchange insurance details with him. All this when he could be playing squash. He feels he's been left behind. And he seems to see it. Receding obliviously down a side street is the other, most likely version of himself, like a vanishing rich uncle, introspective and happy, motoring carefree through his Saturday, leaving him alone and wretched in his new improbable, inescapable fate. This is real. Telling himself it is so betrays how little he believes it yet. He picks his racket off the car floor and puts it back on top of the journal. His right hand is on the door catch. But he doesn't move yet. He's looking in the mirror. There are reasons to be cautious. There are, as he expected, three heads in the car behind. He knows he's subject to unexamined assumptions, and he tries to examine them now. As far as he's aware, lap dancing is a lawful pursuit, but if he'd seen the three men hurrying even furtively from the Wellcome Trust or the British Library, he might already have stepped from his car. That they were running makes it possible they'll be even more irritated than him by the delay. The car is a Series 5 BMW, a vehicle he associates for no good reason with criminality, drug dealing. And there are three men, not one. The shortest is in the front passenger's seat, and the door on that side is opening as he watches, followed immediately by the driver's, and then the rear offside door. Perrone, who does not intend to be trapped into talking from a sitting position, gets out of his car. The half-minute's pause has given the situation a game-like quality, in which calculations have already been made. The three men have their own reasons for holding back and discussing their next move. It's important, Perrone thinks, as he goes round to the front of his car, to remember that he's in the right and that he's angry. He also has to be careful. But these contradictory notions aren't helpful, and he decides he'll be better off feeling his way into the confrontation rather than troubling himself with ground rules. His impulse, then, is to ignore the men, walk away from them, round the front of the Mercedes to get a view of the damaged side. But even as he stands, with hands on hips, in a pose of proprietorial outrage, he keeps the men, now advancing as a group, on the edge of vision. At a glance, there seems to be no damage at all. The wing mirror is intact. There are no dents in the panels. Amazingly, the metallic silver paintwork is clean. He leans forward to catch the light at a different angle. With fingers splayed, he runs a hand lightly over the bodywork as if he really knew what he's about. There is nothing. Not a blemish. In immediate tactical terms, this seems to leave him at a disadvantage. He has nothing to show for his anger. If there's any damage at all, it is out of sight, between the front wheels. The men have stopped to look at something in the road. The short fellow in the black suit touches with the tip of his shoe the BMW's shorn-off wing mirror, turning it over the way one might a dead animal. One of the others, a tall young man with the long, mournful face of a horse, picks it up, cradling it in both hands. They stare down at it together, and then, at a remark from the short man, they turn their faces towards Perrone simultaneously, with abrupt curiosity, like deer disturbed in a forest. For the first time it occurs to him that he might be in some kind of danger. Officially closed off at both ends, the street is completely deserted. Behind the men on the Tottenham Court Road, a broken file of protesters is making its way south to join the main body. Perrone glances over his shoulder. There, behind him on Gower Street, the march proper has begun. Thousands packed in a single dense column are making for Piccadilly, their banners angled forwards heroically, as in a revolutionary poster. From their faces, hands and clothes, they emanate the rich colour, almost like warmth, peculiar to compacted humanity. For dramatic effect, they're walking in silence to the funereal beat of marching drums. The three men resume their approach. As before, the short man, 5'5" or 5'6", perhaps, is out in front. His gait is distinctive, with a little jazzy twist and dip of his trunk, as though he's punting along a gentle stretch of river. The punter from the Spearmint Rhino. Perhaps he's listening to his personal stereo. Some people go nowhere, even into disputes, without a soundtrack. The other two have the manner of subordinates, sidekicks. They're wearing trainers, tracksuits and hooded tops, the currency of the street, so general as to be no style at all. Theo sometimes dresses this way in order, so he says, not to make decisions about how he looks. The horse-faced fellow is still holding the wing mirror in two hands, presumably to make a point. The unrelenting throb of drums is not helpful to the situation, and the fact that so many people are close by, unaware of him, makes Henry feel all the more isolated. It's best to go on looking busy. He drops down closer by the car, noting a squashed Coke can under his front tyre. There is, he sees now with both relief and irritation, an irregular patch on the rear door where the sheen is diminished, as though rubbed with a fine emery cloth. Surely the contact point, confined to a 2-foot patch. How right he was, swerving away before he hit the brake. He feels steadier now, straightening up to face the men as they stop in front of him. Unlike some of his colleagues, the surgical psychopaths, Henry doesn't actually relish personal confrontation. He isn't the machete-wielding type. But clinical experience is, among all else, an abrasive, toughening process, bound to wear away at his sensitivities. Patients, juniors, the recently bereaved, management, of course, inevitably in 2 decades... The moments have come around when he's been required to fight his corner, or explain, or placate in the face of a furious emotional upsurge. There's usually a lot at stake. For colleagues, questions of hierarchy and professional pride, or wasted hospital resources. For patients, a loss of function. For their relatives, a suddenly dead spouse or child. Weightier affairs than a scratched car. Especially when they involve patients, these moments have a purity and innocence about them. Everything is stripped down to the essentials of being. Memory, vision, the ability to recognize faces, chronic pain, motor function, even a sense of self. What lie in the background, glowing faintly, are the issues of medical science, the wonders it performs, the faith it inspires, and against that, its slowly diminishing but still vast ignorance of the brain and the mind, and the relation between the two. Regularly penetrating the skull with some modest success is a relatively recent adventure. There's bound to be disappointment sometimes, and when it comes, the showdown with the relatives in his office, no one needs to calculate how to behave or what to say. No one feels watched. It pours out. Among Perrone's acquaintance are those medics who deal not with the brain, but only with the mind, with the diseases of consciousness. These colleagues embrace a tradition, a set of prejudices only rarely voiced nowadays, that the neurosurgeons are blundering, arrogant fools with blunt instruments, bone-setters let loose upon the most complex object in the known universe. When an operation fails, the patient or the relatives tend to come round to this view. But too late. What is said then is tragic and sincere. However appalling these heartfelt engagements, however much he knows himself to be maligned by a patient's poor or self-serving recollection of how the risks have been outlined, whatever his certainty that he's performed in the theatre as well as current knowledge and techniques allow, Perrone comes away not only chastened, he has manifestly failed to lower expectations, but obscurely purified. He's had a fundamental human exchange, as elemental in its way as love. But here on University Street, it's impossible not to feel that play-acting is about to begin. Dressed as a scarecrow, in mangy fleece, his sweater with its row of holes, his paint-stained trousers supported by a knotted cord, he stands by his powerful machine. He is cast in a role and there's no way out. This, as people like to say, is urban drama. A century of movies and half a century of television have rendered the matter insincere. It's pure artifice. Here are the cars, and here are the owners. Here are the guys, the strangers, whose self-respect is on the line. Someone is going to have to impose his will and win, and the other is going to give way. Popular culture has worn this matter smooth with reiteration, this ancient genetic patrimony that also oils the machinations of bullfrogs and cockerels and stags. And despite the varied and casual dress code, there are rules as elaborate as the politesse of the Versailles court that no set of genes can express. For a start, it is not permitted as they stand there to acknowledge the self-consciousness of the event or its overbearing irony. From just up the street, they can hear the tramping and tribal drums of the peacemongers. Furthermore, nothing can be predicted, but everything, as soon as it happens, will seem to fit.
Cigarette?
Exactly so. This is how it's bound to start. In an old-fashioned gesture, the other driver offers the pack with a snap of the wrist, arranging the untipped cigarettes like organ pipes. The gripped hand extending towards Perrone is large, given the man's height, and papery pale, with black hair coiled on the back and extending to the distal interphalangeal joints. The persistent tremor also draws Perrone's professional attention. Perhaps there's reassurance to be had in the unsteadiness of the grip. I won't, thanks. He lights one for himself and blows the smoke past Henry, who is already 1 point down. Not man enough to smoke, or more essentially to offer gifts. It's important not to be passive. It has to be his move. He puts out his own hand. Henry Perrone.
Baxter.
Mr. Baxter?
Baxter.
Baxter's hand is large, Henry's fractionally larger, but neither man attempts a show of strength. Their handshake is light and brief. Baxter is one of those smokers whose pores exude a perfume, an oily essence of his habit. Garlic affects certain people the same way. Possibly the kidneys are implicated. He's a fidgety, small-faced young man with thick eyebrows and dark brown hair razored close to the skull. The mouth is set bulbously with the smoothly shaved shadow of a strong beard adding to the effect of a muzzle. The general simian air is compounded by sloping shoulders, and the built-up trapezoids suggest time in the gym, compensating for his height, perhaps. The 60s-style suit, tight-cut, high lapels, flap-fronted trousers worn from the hip, is taking some strain around the jacket's single-fastened button. There's also tightness in the fabric round the biceps. He half turns and dips away from Perrone, then bobs back. He gives an impression of fretful impatience, of destructive energy waiting to be released. He may be about to lash out. Perrone is familiar with some of the current literature on violence. It's not always a pathology. Self-interested social organisms find it rational to be violent sometimes. Among the game theorists and radical criminologists, the stock of Thomas Hobbes keeps on rising. Holding the unruly, the thugs in check, is the famous common power to keep all men in awe. A governing body, an arm of the state, freely granted a monopoly on the legitimate use of violence. But drug dealers and pimps, among others who live beyond the law, are not inclined to dial 999 for Leviathan. They settle their quarrels in their own way. Perrone, almost a foot taller than Baxter, considers that if it comes to a scrap, he'll be wise to protect his testicles. But it's a ridiculous thought. He hasn't been in a hand-to-hand fight since he was 8. 3 against 1. He simply won't let it happen. As soon as they've shaken hands, Baxter says,
"I expect you're all ready to tell me how sincerely sorry you are."
He looks back past the Mercedes to his own car, where it's parked at a diagonal across the road. Behind it is an irregular line 3 feet from the ground, scraped along the sides of half a dozen parked cars by the BMW's door handle. The appearance on the street now of just one outraged owner will be enough to set off a cascade of insurance claims. Henry, knowing a good deal about paperwork, can already sense the prolonged trauma of it. Far better to be one of the many victims than the original sinner. He says, "I am indeed sorry that you pulled out without looking." He surprises himself. This fussy, faintly archaic "indeed" is not generally part of his lexicon. Deploying it entails decisions. He isn't going to pretend to the language of the street. He's standing on professional dignity. Baxter lays his left hand on his right, as though to calm it. He says patiently,
"I didn't need to be looking, did I? The Tottenham Court Road's closed. You aren't supposed to be there."
Perrone says, "The rules of the road aren't suspended. Anyway, a policeman waved me across."
"Police? Man?"
Baxter, dividing and leaning on the construction, makes it sound childish. He turns to his friends.
"You seen a police man?"
And then back to Perrone with mocking politeness.
"This is Narc and this is Nigel."
Until now, the two have stood off to one side, just behind Baxter, listening without expression. Nigel is the horse-faced man. His companion may be a police informer or addicted to narcotics or, given his comatose look, presenting with narcolepsy.
"No policeman round here," Nigel explains. "They all busy with the marching scum."
Perrone pretends to ignore both men. His business is with Baxter. This is the moment we swap insurance details. All three chuckle at this, but he continues, If we can't agree on what happened, we'll phone the police. He looks at his watch. Jay Strauss will be on court warming up the ball. It's not too late to settle the matter and get on his way. Baxter hasn't reacted to the mention of a phone call. Instead, he takes the wing mirror from Nigel and displays it to Perrone. The spiderweb fissures in the glass show the sky in mosaics of white and ragged blue, which shimmer with the agitation in Baxter's hand. His tone is genial.
Fortunately for you, I got a mate does bodywork on the cheap. But he does a nice job. $7.50, I reckon he'd sort me out.
Narc rouses himself.
There's a cash point on the corner.
And Nigel, as though pleasantly surprised by the idea, says,
Yeah, we could walk down there with you.
These two have shifted their position so they're almost, but not quite, flanking Henry. Baxter, meanwhile, steps back. The manoeuvrings are clumsily deliberate, like an ill-rehearsed children's ballet. Perrone's attention, his professional regard, settles once again on Baxter's right hand. It isn't simply a tremor. It's a fidgety restlessness implicating practically every muscle. Speculating about it soothes him, even as he feels the shoulders of both men pressing lightly through his fleece. Perversely, he no longer believes himself to be in any great danger. It's hard to take the trio seriously. The cash idea has a boyish make-believe quality. Everything said seems like a quotation from something they've all seen a dozen times before and half forgotten. At the sound of a trumpet expertly played, the four men turn to watch the march. It's a series of intricate staccato runs which end on a high tapering note. It might be a passage from a Bach cantata because Henry immediately imagines a soprano and a sweetly melancholic air, and in the background, a supportive cello squarely sawing away. On Gower Street, the concept of a reproachful funereal march no longer holds. It was difficult to sustain with thousands in a column stretching over hundreds of yards. Now the chants and clapping rise and fall in volume as different sections of the crowd move past the junction with University Street. Baxter's fixed regard is on it as it passes, his features faintly distorted, strained by pity. A textbook phrase comes to Henry in much the same way as the cantata melody. A modest rise in his adrenaline level is making him unusually associative. All the pressures of the past week won't release him from the habits, the intellectual game of diagnosis. The phrase is a false sense of superiority. Yes, it can be down to a slight alteration in character, preceding the first tremors, somewhat short of, a little less disabling than, those other neurological conditions. Grandiosity, delusions of grandeur. But he may be misremembering. Neurology is not his field. As Baxter stares at the marchers, he makes tiny movements with his head, little nods and shakes. Watching him unobserved for a few seconds, Perrone suddenly understands. Baxter is unable to initiate or make saccades, those flickering changes of eye position from one fixation to another. To scan the crowd, he is having to move his head. As though in confirmation, he turns his whole body towards Perrone and says genially,
Horrible rabble, sponging off the country they ate.
Perrone thinks he understands enough about Baxter to know he should get clear. Shrugging off Nigel and Narc at his side, he turns towards his car.
I'm not giving you cash, he says dismissively. I'm giving you my details. If you don't want to give me yours, that's fine. Your registration number will do. I'll be on my way.
He then adds barely truthfully, I'm late for an important meeting. But most of this sentence is obliterated by a single sound, a shout of rage. Even as he turns back towards Baxter in surprise, and even as he sees or senses what's coming towards him at such speed, There remains in a portion of his thoughts a droning pedestrian diagnostician who notes poor self-control, emotional lability, explosive temper, suggestive of reduced levels of GABA among the appropriate binding sites on striatal neurons. This in turn is bound to imply the diminished presence of two enzymes in the striatum and lateral pallidum, glutamic acid decarboxylase and choline acetyltransferase. There is much in human affairs that can be accounted for at the level of the complex molecule. Who could ever reckon up the damage done to love and friendship and all hopes of happiness by a surfeit or depletion of this or that neurotransmitter? And who will ever find a morality, an ethics down among the enzymes and amino acids when the general taste is for looking in the other direction? In her second year at Oxford, dazzled by some handsome fool of a teacher, Daisy tried to convince her father that madness was a social construct, a wheeze by means of which the rich, he may have got this wrong, squeezed the poor. Father and daughter engaged in one of their energetic arguments, which ended with Henry, in a rhetorical coup, offering her a tour of a closed psychiatric wing. Resolutely, she accepted, and then the matter was forgotten. Despite Baxter's impaired ocular fixation and his career, those quick, jerky movements, the blow that's aimed at Perrone's heart and that he dodges only fractionally lands on his sternum with colossal force, so that it seems to him, and perhaps it really is the case, that there surges throughout his body a sharp ridge, a shock wave of high blood pressure, a concussive thrill that carries with it not so much pain as an electric jolt of stupefaction and a brief, deathly chill that has a visual component of blinding, snowy whiteness.
"All right,"
he hears Baxter say, which is an instruction to his companions. They grab Henry by his elbows and forearms, and as his vision clears, he sees that he's being propelled through a gap between two parked cars. Together they cross the pavement at speed. They turn him and slam his back against a chain-locked double door in a recess. He sees on the wall to his left a polished brass plaque which says, "Fire Exit, Spearmint Rhino." Just up the street is a pub, the Jeremy Bentham. But if it's open this early, the drinkers are all inside in the warmth. Perrone has two immediate priorities whose importance holds as his full consciousness returns. The first is to keep the promise to himself not to fight back. The punch has already told him how much expertise he lacks. The second is to stay on his feet. He's seen a fair number of brain injuries among those unlucky enough to fall to the ground before their attackers. The foot, like some roughneck hick town, is a remote province of the brain, liberated by distance from responsibility. A kick is less intimate, less involving than a punch, and one kick never quite seems enough. Back in the epic days of organized football violence, when he was a registrar, he learned a good deal about subdural hematomas from steel-tipped Doc Martens. He stands facing them in a little whitewashed brick cave of a recess well out of sight of the march. The structure amplifies the rasp of their breathing. Nigel takes a fistful of Perrone's fleece and with the other hand seeks out the bulge of his wallet, which is in an inside zipped pocket.
"Nah," Baxter says. "We don't want his money."
By this Perrone understands that honour is to be satisfied by a thorough beating. As with the insurance claims, he sees the dreary future ahead. Weeks of painful convalescence. Perhaps that's optimistic. Baxter's gaze is on him, a gaze that can't be shifted unless he moves the whole of his heavy, shaven head. His face is alive with small tremors that never quite form into an expression. It is a muscular restlessness that will one day, this is Perrone's considered opinion, become athetoid, plagued by involuntary, uncontrollable movements. There's a sense among the trio of a pause for breath, a steadying before the business. Narc is already bunching his right fist. Perrone notes three rings on the index, middle and ring fingers, bands of gold as broad as sawn-off plumbing. He has, he reckons, a few seconds left. Baxter is in his mid-twenties. This isn't the moment to be asking for a family history. If a parent has it, you have a 50-50 chance of going down too. Chromosome 4. The misfortune lies with a single gene in an excessive repeat of a single sequence, CAG. Here's biological determinism in its purest form. More than 40 repeats of that one little codon, and you're doomed. Your future is fixed and easily foretold. The longer the repeat, the earlier and more severe the onset. Between 10 and 20 years to complete the course, from the first small alterations of character, tremors in the hands and face, emotional disturbance, including most notably sudden uncontrollable alterations of mood, to the helpless, jerky dance-like movements, intellectual dilapidation, memory failure, agnosia, apraxia, dementia, total loss of muscular control, rigidity sometimes, nightmarish hallucinations, and a meaningless end. This is how the brilliant machinery of being is undone by the tiniest of faulty cogs, the insidious whisper of ruin, a single bad idea lodged in every cell, on every chromosome 4. Nark is drawing back his right arm to strike. Nigel seems content to let him go first. Henry has heard that early onset tends to indict the paternal gene. But that might not be right. There's nothing to lose by making a guess. He speaks into the blaze of Baxter's regard. Your father had it. Now you've got it too. He has the impression of himself as a witch doctor delivering a curse. Baxter's expression is hard to judge. He makes a vague, febrile movement with his left hand to restrain his companions. There's silence as he swallows and strains forward, frowning as if about to clear an obstruction from his throat. Perrone has expressed himself ambiguously. His had could easily have been taken for a has. And Baxter's father, alive or dead, might not even be known to his son. But Perrone is counting on Baxter knowing about his condition. If he does, he won't have told Nigel or Nark or any of his friends. This is his secret shame. He may be in denial, knowing and not knowing, knowing and preferring not to think about it. When Baxter speaks at last, his voice is different. Cautious, perhaps.
You knew my father?
I'm a doctor.
Like fuck you are, dressed like that.
I'm a doctor. Has someone explained to you what's going to happen? Do you want me to tell you what I think your problem might be? It works. The shameless blackmail works. Baxter flares suddenly.
What problem?
And before Perrone can reply, he adds ferociously,
And you'll shut the fuck up!
Then, as quickly, he subsides and turns away. They are together, he and Perrone, in a world not of the medical, but of the magical. When you're diseased, it is unwise to abuse the shaman. Nigel says,
What's going on? What did your dad have? Shut up.
This ends Disc 3.